The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to Short Circuit, your podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeals. I'm your host, John Ross, joined today by IJ Senior Attorney Robert McNamara and IJ Florida Managing Attorney Justin Pearson. Bob, let's kick things off with some big news from the U.S. Supreme Court.
Big news from the U.S. Supreme Court in a case called Brownback v. King, an IJ case that we're litigating as part of our overall project on government immunity and accountability. The case involves James King, a young man who was accosted and brutally beaten by plainclothes officers who were looking for a suspect who looked absolutely nothing like James King, and were dressed in plain clothes and never identified themselves. And so James, from his perspective, was... essentially being mugged, and did what you do when you're being mugged and tried to escape.
Bob, we talked about the case last week. We talked about the fact that there were dueling cert petitions. Ours did not get granted, but the government's did. I think folks who listen to the show will remember more or less the brutal beating. But can you tell us what it means going forward for the government's petition to have been granted and not ours?
So what it means is the Supreme Court is going to answer this question of whether the Federal Tort Claims Act acts as a hard bar against any other claims you might have against government officials. And you'll remember from last week, loyal listeners, that it's not really clear how you sue members of a federal state task force. Are they federal agents? Are they state agents? And so what a reasonable lawyer is going to do is sue under every available claim and let the court sort it out. That's how you litigate. And in this case, that's what his lawyers did, and they filed a Federal Tort Claims Act claim, they filed a Bivens Act claim, they filed a Section 1983 claim, and the district court, and what the courts have said is, no, it's not the Tort Claims Act, it's not Section 1983, it's supposed to be Bivens. And what the government is asking the Supreme Court to do is say the mere fact that you initially pled the Federal Tort Claims Act is supposed to be a complete barrier to any other relief, which means not only can we make you play this guessing game, but if you don't play the guessing game perfectly, then all of your other meritorious claims are thrown out of court. That's not an argument we expect the Supreme Court to be super excited about based on its past pronouncements in the area, but it's tremendously important for our overall project of making sure that government officials who violate the Constitution can be held to account in court. And really what the government's asking for in the Brownback case is another exception to the general rule that applies to all the rest of us, which is that when we violate the law, we are held responsible for our wrongdoing.
Okay, so when do we expect argument to be?
Argument will be held in next year's October term. It's not totally clear exactly when it will be held. They don't always argue cases in the order in which they were granted, though I can tell you based on past experience, because it's an IJ case, I expect it will be argued in the depths of February when it's very, very cold to wait outside the court.
All right, Justin, tell us about your cert petition.
Happy to. So we filed a cert petition on behalf of civil forfeiture victim Melata Salgado. The Supreme Court justices are scheduled to review it at their conference this Friday. So we're very excited. We have our fingers crossed. But it touches on maybe the only thing that's just about as disturbing as qualified immunity, which is civil forfeiture. And basically what happened was DEA agents raided Melata's house based solely on a tip from a confidential informant that turned out to be completely false. Upon raiding her house and realizing that there was no evidence there to substantiate the tip, they took her money anyway. That money consisted of $15,000, which she had mostly compiled from gifts from relatives, and part of which she was going to use on her teenage daughter's 15th birthday quinceañera, because the law enforcement agents wrongfully seized her money. She had to cancel the quinceañera, which of course is heartbreaking, but things got even worse from there. Even though the lead DEA agent admitted in his deposition that they had no evidence connecting the money or Melata's to any criminal activity, they nonetheless held her money for 2 years, forced her to hire an attorney, and then waited until the eve of a summary judgment ruling to suddenly return the money and say that now, because they were dismissing the case without prejudice and before the court had ruled on the merits, she could not be awarded her attorney's fees.
So what does that mean?
So it means that she can't be made whole. And not only is that troubling, but it also violates the statute. The relevant statute is the Civil Asset Forfeiture Reform Act of 2000, often called CAFRA for short. And Congress specifically tried to address this problem to make people like Mulatus whole. What the statute says is that the DOJ has a 90-day review period, which is functionally 150 days once you factor in other deadlines, to decide whether to return seized money or proceed with a forfeiture lawsuit. If they go forward at the end of that review period, then they are responsible for any attorney's fees accrued by any claimant who substantially prevails. And that's a legal term of art that is meant to be less demanding on claimants than prevails. But unfortunately, we now have this judge-made doctrine where the judiciary has created a get-out-of-jail-free card for the DOJ that basically says, as long as you return the money before the court rules at summary judgment, which is usually about 2 years after the seizure, we are not going to make you pay the claimant's fees. In other words, you know, if by some miracle the claimant is actually able to survive for 2 years without their life savings, they still won't be made whole because the courts will allow the DOJ to game the system. That's not the way things are supposed to work. That's not what the statute says. And so we filed a cert petition asking the court to take the case and actually apply the plain text of the reform.
Okay, that's enough IJ news for this week. All right, Justin, tell us about the First Circuit's ruling in the Sanctuary Cities case.
I'd be happy to, and I commend this case to anyone's attention who cares about textualism or is just interested in the canons of construction, because this case really provides a tutorial, as does the Second Circuit case that disagrees with it. There's actually a circuit split on this issue, which is why, you know, it's now more likely that the Supreme Court may weigh in at some point. But basically what's going on here is, as I'm sure our listeners know, certain cities around the nation have decided to designate themselves as sanctuary cities and basically say that they're not going to help the federal government when it comes to certain immigration issues. The DOJ responded by saying that those sanctuary cities will no longer be eligible for the Edward Byrne Memorial Justice Assistance Grant Program, which basically just means there was money that the federal government was giving to local law enforcement for certain purposes. And the DOJ decided that if these cities were going to become sanctuary cities, then they were no longer eligible for this grant money. But what these cases really, you know, boil down to, it's not a policy dispute. What it is it's a review of the plain text of the statute. And that text includes figuring out what a word like applicable means, you know, whether applicable federal laws mean something different than all federal laws. It also looks at a statutory provision that has to deal with the powers of the attorney general and the assistant attorney general and the term including, you know, how should that be construed? And so I think the First Circuit does a terrific job. I should point out that retired Supreme Court Justice Souter was on the panel, although he did not write the opinion. But the opinion goes through a lengthy analysis, applying quite a few different canons of construction, and finally comes to the conclusion that the DOJ does not have the power under the statute to withhold this money. Although it is complicated, I think the First Circuit reached the correct conclusion. I think the Second Circuit, which went the other way, is wrong. I should also point out that the First Circuit is agreeing with the Ninth and the Seventh Circuit, although all for different reasons. And so we
and
have
the Third Circuit.
Yes, exactly. And so we have all these different circuits who have all reached different conclusions, one which went one way, a group of other circuits that went the other way, but again, for different reasons. And so it does seem more likely than maybe many other cases that the Supreme Court will weigh in at some time. And when they do, we can expect to receive yet another tutorial on textualism, which should be fascinating to read.
Just for clarity, Justin, I think the Second Circuit is the only circuit that has said the Attorney General can withhold the funds.
That is correct.
Bob, you have big thoughts about the case or little thoughts?
I have big thoughts about everything. I mean, I think the interesting thing about this whole debate is for those of us who have been kind of practicing and watching constitutional law for more than just the past 2 years, which sometimes reading the newspaper, it seems like everyone has just sort of come to these issues fully formed in the past 2 years. The valence of these questions has completely shifted politically from the last time you really had a spate of cases dealing with this question, which was the litigation over Obamacare. And in Obamacare, it was the same question of, you know, can the federal government force states to set up these healthcare exchanges on pain of withholding federal healthcare dollars? And the Supreme Court there said no, that was an overreach based on kind of the pre-existing statutes and the pre-existing entitlement to that money. And here it strikes me as arguments that absolutely rhyme, that are directly analogous, but the political valence has completely switched. And I think it's very much to the court's credit that the analysis of judges in these cases has not completely switched. But if you read a newspaper article about any of these cases, it's just completely a 180 from what you would have read 10 years ago, where basically the same arguments about the ability of the federal government to use federal funding as a string to make states dance to its tune were in play. And you know, I think we're seeing similar outcomes in the lower courts as what we saw in the Obamacare cases, and we are seeing different reactions from the public in a way that I think kind of speaks to the importance of educating the public about how the Constitution works and how these principles apply differently depending on what they may apply differently based on your political leanings, depending on what exactly the federal government is trying to force states to do.
I think that's mostly true, and I think it's a good point. I do want to point out, though, that the Obamacare case is mostly dealt with constitutional challenges, whereas here it's a statutory question. It's a question of whether – it's not a question of whether Congress could have granted this authority. It's a question of whether they did grant this authority pursuant to the statute. However, I nonetheless agree with Bob's point. I mean, you know, you look at the First Circuit opinion, and then you look at the Second Circuit opinion, and supposedly they're analyzing the same language, but they reach opposite conclusions. And so in addition to agreeing with everything Bob just said, I also want to point out that, you know, textualism is not some sort of magic talisman. Two different courts can apply textualism and arrive at different conclusions. They're useful guideposts, but at the end of the day, you have judges who are human beings conducting this analysis.
The First Circuit points out that there were several bills in Congress that would have required cities to conform to these conditions, but none of them got passed. Does that affect the analysis at all?
I don't think it should. Thankfully, it is pretty difficult to pass legislation. It's also, unfortunately, difficult to repeal legislation. And so the fact that someone tried to change something and did not succeed does not necessarily mean that the law, you know, says one thing or another. You have to look at the plain text of the statute. Thankfully, you know, or at least supposedly, we live in a nation governed by laws, not men. And so what matters are the words in the text of the statute, not the idiosyncratic intents of the flawed individuals who wrote those laws or voted for those laws or later tried to amend those laws successfully or not.
I think that's largely true, though. There is a place, I think, for analysis of actual legislative behavior. It doesn't trump the statutory text, but it's certainly not irrelevant that a number of people in Congress looked at this statutory text and thought, this text doesn't go far enough. This doesn't do what I want it to do. This doesn't attach the strings I wish we had attached to this money in the first place. And so we should do that. Is that dispositive? No. Does it trump the text? Absolutely not. But it's certainly something that if the opposite were true, I think people on the other side would seize on it and say, look, you know, when that Congress has never felt the need to try to amend this. And so it's certainly a data point you can look at to the extent you find the text ambiguous. And, you know, here the court doesn't say the text is ambiguous. And if the text isn't ambiguous, then you should stick with what the words say.
So 2 points in response. First, I want to point out, and I think Bob probably agrees with this, that courts are too quick to decide that language is ambiguous. And so right off the bat, I want to point out that that conclusion that text is ambiguous should be reached far less frequently than it currently is. But second of all, even when you're dealing with ambiguity, I want to respectfully disagree with Bob, which is always a dangerous thing to do, and I hold him in high regard. But as you may know, I do a substantial amount of work in state legislatures and in the Florida legislature in particular. And my experience there leads me to have absolutely no faith that any of those actions indicate anything other than the certain political wills of the moment that may be completely disconnected of the rationales provided for them.
Oh, I yield to no one in my general disregard for the good faith of the legislature, but I do think it's a data point that people can look at this text and say, you know what, this text doesn't achieve what we want it to achieve, and so we should pass this law. And they fail to pass this law. And Then, when the government goes back to that same text that was not amended and says, hey, you know, and sometimes this comes up and there are different levels of kind of, there are different degrees to which the legislature can try to do this. This came up in an IJ case just a few years ago where the IRS was trying to assert that it had pre-existing statutory authority to regulate tax preparers. And it didn't have that statutory authority, but it was actually a relevant data point that the IRS itself had repeatedly gone to Congress and said, hey, Congress, you need to amend the statutes to give us this authority. And Congress had not done that. And lo and behold, after it went to Congress and failed to get the authority that it had wanted, it went spelunking through the statutes on its own and said, hey, the statutory text means this, and it's always meant this. And of course, the text controls, and if the text said that they had this authority, none of that would matter. But I think it's hard from an analytical perspective to say that we can totally close our eyes to that reality, that the agency, whose incentive was to maximize its own power, repeatedly thought it didn't have this power, repeatedly went to Congress, and to say that that doesn't factor into the analysis ever in any circumstances, I think is just requiring us to do the statutory analysis divorced from actual reality on the ground. The people at the IRS who were in charge of interpreting the statutes thought they needed Congress to act and only changed their minds after Congress failed to act. I have a hard time saying that's not a data point that a court can consider.
I completely agree with that, but it's not what we're talking about. What we were talking about was whether it matters that legislators have attempted to amend a statute unsuccessfully. I completely agree that an agency position, which it has followed for a long period of time, matters, especially when after that long period of time, the agency suddenly changes its position without going through the rulemaking process. I disagree, though, that the question of whether a legislator has tried to amend a statute should matter in reviewing the text of that statute that they failed to amend. I've seen how legislators operate, and I just don't think it's a relevant data point.
No, that's an interesting position. I mean, I can see the purely textualist argument that you can't look at any of this, but it seems to me that once you're looking outside the text, the question of who did it is a question of degree rather than a question of whether you can look at it.
I disagree. I think it's these are two different situations. I think being an agency or being a representative of an agency is very different than being a legislator.
Well, dear listeners, I hope you will look deep within inside yourselves and think about whether Bob or Justin is right on this. But we're going to move on to the final case, which comes out of the 11th Circuit and involves gold bars. Bob.
All right, so we have the aptly named United States v. Goldman, a case which I commend to the attention of anyone who cares about buried treasure or the film The Goonies, because it's a case about gold, man. And it centers around apparently famed sunken treasure investigator, though I confess before I read the decision I had not heard of him, Mel Fisher. And Mel Fisher was basically Indiana Jones on a boat. He went and he recovered the treasure from sunken Spanish galleons, which proved to be quite lucrative. And among the other things Mr. Fisher did at the end of his career, he endowed a museum displaying many of the nautical treasures that he had founded. Including a solid gold bar that the museum made the centerpiece of its attraction, because this gold bar you could actually touch. They had it in a special case where you could put your hands in and lift the gold bar and feel how heavy this gold bar was. And the problem with that is that a couple young men drove 6 hours to go to the museum and lifted the bar. And they lifted the bar a little more than the museum wanted you to, and made off with it. And apparently one of them kept it, and over the course of the ensuing time period, anytime he needed money, he sawed off a little of the gold bar and was eventually caught and convicted. And the question on appeal is, at his trial, he's convicted of stealing the gold bar, but a question arises for purposes of sentencing and restitution of how much the gold bar is worth. If you melted it down, it'd be about $65,000 worth of gold. I think their insurance company ended up paying them about $100,000. The museum's insurance company paid $100,000. But at trial, the museum put up a witness that testified that their valuation of the gold bar was that it was worth about $500,000. And it was worth about $500,000 because it had this long history of people picking it up and putting it back down in the museum. And their witness said that if Elvis had owned a gold bar, that gold bar would be worth a lot more than its weight in gold. And so this was as well. And the 11th Circuit looks at this and says, well, the sentence is substantively reasonable, but also as part of his conviction, the defendant is required to pay restitution. And you cannot require him to pay restitution in the amount of $500,000 if there's no evidence that the gold bar is worth $500,000. And the actual testimony, the way the museum gets to the valuation of $500,000, is their witness says that the gold bar is worth a certain number of Mel Fisher investor points. And each Mel Fisher investor point has a dollar value. And you multiply the number of Mel Fisher investor points by the total dollar value of a Mel Fisher investor point, and that's how you get to this $500,000 number. And savvy listeners at this point are probably asking, what's a Mel Fisher investor point? How do you figure out how many Mel Fisher investor points a particular artifact gets? And they did not have an answer. No one at the hearing testified about how you get to a Mel Fisher investor point valuation. And so the appellate court said, look, you can sentence the guy, but you can't make him pay $500,000 in restitution based on Mel Fisher investor points when there's nothing in the record that tells us what a Mel Fisher investor point is. You can't order restitution in a random number. And so it's sent back down to figure out not just whether this bar is worth more than its weight in gold, but actually precisely how much more than its weight in gold the bar is worth.
Justin, you shared a really fun fact about this case with us earlier over email. Would you relate that to our listeners now?
Sure. One of the wonderful things about living in South Florida is I visit Key West relatively frequently, and I have been to the Mel Fisher Maritime Museum on more than one occasion, and I've held that gold bar. And it's really interesting. It's not shaped the way you would think of for a gold bar nowadays. It's more like this really long, thin, it almost looks like a gold churro. But they've got this case that kind of mimics the same proportions, although obviously larger, with a hole in the middle where you can stick your hand in and kind of grab the middle of the gold bar. Obviously, it's shaped in such a way that you can't turn it 90 degrees and get it through the hole. But of course, that system fails if someone actually breaks the box and takes the gold bar out that way, which is what happened in the case.
Are you kicking yourself you didn't think of that?
I kick myself for many reasons often, but that's not one of them.
How many Mel Fisher investor points do you think it was worth?
Well, it's really hard to say because they won't say how they devised this system. So I don't know if it's worth, 9,000 Mel Fisher investor points or 3.5 stars or 8 unicorns. I just have no idea, which was one of the problems, encountered by the circuit court. I do want to point out, though, that there were two parts of the opinion or really the argument by the museum that I thought were interesting as someone who had been to the museum and held the gold bar. First, the museum argued that the bar was more valuable because that particular bar, that specific bar, had been held by 3 or 4 million people. I can tell you that when I visited the museum, the fact that 3 or 4 million people had held that bar did not appeal to me. If I had thought about it, it might have even disgusted me. But I was sympathetic to their second argument, which is that the fact that it's a historic gold bar from a sunken ship from centuries ago, that makes it more valuable than just its weight in gold. I think that's definitely true. It's also disappointing that according to the opinion, the museum does not have any other gold bars left from that ship. They've all been sold to individuals who apparently are not interested in selling one of those gold bars back to the museum. So I am very sympathetic to the argument that because it's difficult to find another gold bar of such historic value, because it was on the ship, not because it was held by many people, that raises the value. And I do think that's correct.
Yeah, and that's an issue that obviously is near and dear to IJ's heart. It comes up a lot in the context of eminent domain and the law of takings, where the government takes property and says, oh, well, all we owe you is just the generic replacement value of going out and buying another gold bar, or just going and getting another half-acre tract of land, and property owners are put in the position of saying, no, like giving me the cash to go buy another gold bar doesn't actually replace what you've taken from me. And so it's certainly something we have fought a lot about, though not in the context of gold bars or of criminal convictions.
I felt a little bit sad for the defendant in this case who was not the fellow who lifted the bar. Apparently, Jared Goldman was just the fellow who was the lookout and agreed to do that for $2,000, which he never saw any of. And yet he's still on the hook for this massive restitution. And essentially the same amount of jail as the actual crook who pled guilty, whereas Jared Goldman went to trial.
No, I mean, it certainly seems like he got a raw deal. And to be frank, I think the reason he is featured in the opinion to the extent he is that his name is Goldman and the panel is delighted by the fact that his name is Goldman. But it's certainly an object lesson in kind of the disparity of consequences you can face depending on the degree of your involvement in the crime, or irrespective, rather, of your degree of involvement in the crime.
Yeah, and I also want to point out that although the valuation was important for the sentencing component, the idea that either one of these individuals is going to pay back over $500,000 is pretty far-fetched, and it actually touches on an issue we see over and over again, where people, even once they're released from jail, are saddled by fines and fees that everyone knows they will never pay back, and that's a national problem.
Okay. Unless you have any further deep thoughts, that concludes the show. Until next time, this is John Ross from the Institute for Justice, hoping that you will get engaged.